Chapter 55. I had confident expectations that things would come round and be all square, says Mr. Jobling with some vagueness of expression and perhaps of meaning too. But I was disappointed. They never did. And when it came to creditors making rows at the office, and to people that the office dealt with making complaints about dirty trifles of borrowed money, why, there was an end of that connection. And of any new professional connection too, for if I was to give a reference to Morrow, it would be mentioned, and would sew me up. Then what's a fellow to do? I have been keeping out of the way and living cheap down about the market gardens, but what's the use of living cheap when you have got no money? You might as well live dear. Better, Mr. Smallweed thinks. Certainly. It's the fashionable way, and fashion and whiskers have been my weaknesses, and I don't care who knows it, says Mr. Jobling. They are great weaknesses, damn, sir, they are great. Well, proceeds Mr. Jobling after a defiant visit to his rum and water, what can a fellow do, I ask you, but enlist? Mr. Guppy comes more fully into the conversation to state what, in his opinion, a fellow can do. His manner is the gravely impressive manner of a man who has not committed himself in life otherwise than as he has become the victim of a tender sorrow of the heart. Jobling, says Mr. Guppy, myself and our mutual friend Smallweed, Mr. Smallweed modestly observes, gentlemen both, and drinks, have had a little conversation on this matter more than once since you, say, got the sack, cries Mr. Jobling bitterly. Say it, Guppy. You mean it. No, oh, oh. Left the inn, Mr. Smallweed delicately suggests. Since you left the inn, Jobling, says Mr. Guppy, and I have mentioned to our mutual friend Smallweed a plan I have lately thought of proposing. You know Snagsby the stationer? I know there is such a stationer, returns Mr. Jobling. He was not ours, and I am not acquainted with him. He is ours, Jobling, and I am acquainted with him, Mr. Guppy retorts. Well, sir, I have lately become better acquainted with him through some accidental circumstances that have made me a visitor of his in private life. Those circumstances it is not necessary to offer in argument. They may or they may not have some reference to a subject which may or may not have cast its shadow on my existence. As it is Mr. Guppy's perplexing way with boastful misery to tempt his particular friends into this subject, and the moment they touch it, to turn on them with that trenchant severity about the courts and the human mind, both Mr. Jobling and Mr. Smallweed decline the pitfall by remaining silent. Such things may be, repeats Mr. Guppy, or they may not be. They are no part of the case. It is enough to mention that both Mr. and Mrs. Snagsby are very willing to oblige me, and that Snagsby has, in busy times, a good deal of copying work to give out. He has all Tulkinghorn's, and an excellent business besides. I believe if our mutual friend Smallweed were put into the box, he could prove this? Mr. Smallweed nods, and appears greedy to be sworn. Now, gentlemen of the jury, says Mr. Guppy, I mean, now, Jobling, you may say this is a poor prospect of a living. Granted. But it's better than nothing, and better than enlistment. You want time. There must be time for these late affairs to blow over. You might live through it on much worse terms than by writing for Snagsby. Mr. Jobling is about to interrupt when the sagacious Smallweed checks him with a dry cough and the words, hem. Shakespeare. There are two branches to this subject, Jobling, says Mr. Guppy. That is the first. I come to the second. You know Crook, the Chancellor, across the lane. Come, Jobling, says Mr. Guppy in his encouraging cross-examination tone. I think you know Crook, the Chancellor, across the lane? I know him by sight, says Mr. Jobling. You know him by sight. Very well. And you know Little Flight? Everybody knows her, says Mr. Jobling. Everybody knows her. Very well. Now it has been one of my duties of late to pay Flight a certain weekly allowance, deducting from it the amount of her weekly rent, which I have paid in consequence of instructions I have received to Crook himself, regularly in her presence. This has brought me into communication with Crook, and into a knowledge of his house and his habits. I know he has a room to let. You may live there at a very low charge under any name you like, as quietly as if you were 100 miles off. He'll ask no questions, and would accept you as a tenant at a word from me before the clock strikes, if you chose. And I tell you another thing, Jobling, says Mr. Guppy, who has suddenly lowered his voice, and become familiar again. He's an extraordinary old chap, always rummaging among a litter of papers and grubbing away at teaching himself to read and write, without getting on a bit, as it seems to me. He is a most extraordinary old chap, sir. I don't know, but what it might be worth a fellow's while, to look him up a bit. You don't mean, Mr. Jobling begins. I mean, returns Mr. Guppy, shrugging his shoulders with becoming modesty, that I can't make him out. I appeal to our mutual friend Smallweed, whether he has or has not heard me remark, that I can't make him out. Mr. Smallweed bears the concise testimony, a few. I have seen something of the profession, and something of life, Tony, says Mr. Guppy, and it's seldom I can't make a man out, more or less. But such an old card as this, so deep, so sly, and secret, though I don't believe he is ever sober, I never came across. Now, he must be precious old, you know, and he has not a soul about him, and he is reported to be immensely rich. And whether he is a smuggler, or a receiver, or an unlicensed pawnbroker, or a moneylender, all of which I have thought likely at different times it might pay you to knock up a sort of knowledge of him. I don't see why you shouldn't go in for it, when everything else suits. Mr. Jobling, Mr. Guppy, and Mr. Smallweed all lean their elbows on the table, and their chins upon their hands, and look at the ceiling. After a time, they all drink, slowly lean back, put their hands in their pockets, and look at one another. If I had the energy I once possessed, Tony, says Mr. Guppy with a sigh. But there are chords in the human mind, expressing the remainder of the desolate sentiment in rum and water. Mr. Guppy concludes by resigning the adventure to Tony Jobling, and informing him that during the vacation, and while things are slack, his purse, as far as 3, or 4, or even 5 pounds goes, will be at his disposal. For never shall it be said, Mr. Guppy adds with emphasis, that William Guppy turned his back upon his friend. The latter part of the proposal is so directly to the purpose that Mr. Jobling says with emotion, Guppy, my trump, your fist. Mr. Guppy presents it, saying, Jobling, my boy, there it is. Mr. Jobling returns, Guppy, we have been pals now for some years. Mr. Guppy replies, Jobling, we have. They then shake hands, and Mr. Jobling adds in a feeling manner, Thank you, Guppy, I don't know, but what I will take another glass for old acquaintance sake. Crook's last lodger died there, observes Mr. Guppy in an incidental way. Did he though? Says Mr. Jobling. There was a verdict. Accidental death. You don't mind that? No, says Mr. Jobling, I don't mind it, but he might as well have died somewhere else. It's devilish odd that he need go and die at my place. Mr. Jobling quite resents this liberty, several times returning to it with such remarks as, There are places enough to die in, I should think. Or, he wouldn't have liked my dying at his place, I dare say. However, the compact being virtually made, Mr. Guppy proposes to dispatch the trusty Smallweed to ascertain if Mr. Crook is at home, as in that case they may complete the negotiation without delay. Mr. Jobling approving, Smallweed puts himself under the tall hat, and conveys it out of the dining rooms in the Guppy manner. He soon returns with the intelligence that Mr. Crook is at home, and that he has seen him through the shop door, sitting in the back premises, sleeping like 1 o'clock. Then I'll pay, says Mr. Guppy, and we'll go and see him. Small, what will it be? Mr. Smallweed, compelling the attendance of the waitress with one hitch of his eyelash, instantly replies as follows. 4 veals and hams is 3, and 4 potatoes is 3 and 4, and 1 summer cabbage is 3 and 6, and 3 marrows is 4 and 6, and 6 breads is 5, and 3 cheshires is 5 and 3, and 4 half pints of half and half is 6 and 3, and 4 small rums is 8 and 3, and 3 pollies is 8 and 6. 8 and 6 in half a sovereign, polly, and 18 pence out. Not at all excited by these stupendous calculations, Smallweed dismisses his friends with a cool nod, and remains behind to take a little admiring notice of Polly, as opportunity may serve, and to read the daily papers, which are so very large in proportion to himself, shorn of his hat, that when he holds up the Times to run his eye over the columns, he seems to have retired for the night, and to have disappeared under the bedclothes. Mr. Guppy and Mr. Jobling repair to the rag and bottle shop, where they find Crook still sleeping like 1 o'clock, that is to say, breathing stertorously with his chin upon his breast, and quite insensible to any external sounds, or even to gentle shaking. On the table beside him, among the usual lumber, stand an empty gin bottle and a glass. The unwholesome air is so stained with this liquor, that even the green eyes of the cat upon her shelf, as they open, and shut and glimmer on the visitors, look drunk. Hold up here, says Mr. Guppy, giving the relaxed figure of the old man another shake. Mr. Crook. Hello, sir. But it would seem as easy to wake a bundle of old clothes with a spirituous heat smoldering in it. Did you ever see such a stupor as he falls into, between drink and sleep? Says Mr. Guppy. If this is his regular sleep, returns Jobling, rather alarmed, it'll last a long time one of these days, I am thinking. It's always more like a fit than a nap, says Mr. Guppy, shaking him again. Hello, your lordship. Why, he might be robbed 50 times over. Open your eyes. After much ado, he opens them, but without appearing to see his visitors or any other objects. Though he crosses one leg on another, and folds his hands, and several times closes and opens his parched lips, he seems to all intents and purposes as insensible as before. He is alive, at any rate, says Mr. Guppy. How are you, my Lord Chancellor? I have brought a friend of mine, sir, on a little matter of business. The old man still sits, often smacking his dry lips without the least consciousness. After some minutes he makes an attempt to rise. They help him up, and he staggers against the wall and stares at them. How do you do, Mr. Crook? Says Mr. Guppy in some discomfiture. How do you do, sir? You are looking charming, Mr. Crook. I hope you are pretty well. The old man, in aiming a purposeless blow at Mr. Guppy, or at nothing, feebly swings himself round and comes with his face against the wall. So he remains for a minute or two, heaped up against it, and then staggers down the shop to the front door. The air, the movement in the court, the lapse of time, or the combination of these things recovers him. He comes back pretty steadily, adjusting his fur cap on his head and looking keenly at them. Your servant, gentlemen. I've been dozing. Hi. I am hard to wake, odd times. Rather so, indeed, sir, responds Mr. Guppy. What? You've been a-trying to do it, have you? Says the suspicious Crook. Only a little, Mr. Guppy explains. The old man's eye resting on the empty bottle, he takes it up, examines it, and slowly tilts it upside down. I say, he cries like the hobgoblin in the story. Somebody's been making free here. I assure you we found it so, says Mr. Guppy. Would you allow me to get it filled for you? Yes, certainly I would. Cries Crook in high glee. Certainly I would. Don't mention it. Get it filled next door, Soul's Arms, the Lord Chancellor's for teenpenny. Bless you, they know me. He so presses the empty bottle upon Mr. Guppy that that gentleman, with a nod to his friend, accepts the trust and hurries out, and hurries in again with the bottle filled. The old man receives it in his arms like a beloved grandchild, and pats it tenderly, But, I say, he whispers, with his eyes screwed up, after tasting it, this ain't the Lord Chancellor's for teenpenny. This is a teenpenny. I thought you might like that better, says Mr. Guppy. You're a nobleman, sir, returns Crook with another taste, and his hot breath seems to come towards them like a flame. You're a baron of the land. Taking advantage of this auspicious moment, Mr. Guppy presents his friend under the impromptu name of Mr. Weevil, and states the object of their visit. Crook, with his bottle under his arm, he never gets beyond a certain point of either drunkenness or sobriety, takes time to survey his proposed lodger, and seems to approve of him. You'd like to see the room, young man? He says. Ah, it's a good room. Been whitewashed. Been cleaned down with soft soap and soda. Hi. It's worth twice the rent, letting alone my company, when you wanted and such a cat, to keep the mice away. Commending the room after this manner, the old man takes them upstairs, where indeed they do find it cleaner than it used to be, and also containing some old articles of furniture which he has dug. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.